Thank you, and welcome back to what is our last panel of what has been, I think, a very productive day of conversations around the net choice cases and the future of online speech. My name is Jennifer Huddleston, and I am a technology policy research fellow here at the Cato Institute. I'm very excited about this last panel, not only for those of you who are joining us in the room, but in some ways, particularly for those of you that are tuning in online, because what we're really going to be discussing is what could these cases and what do things like the Florida and Texas laws, as well as some of the laws we've seen around the world, mean for the future of online speech for the everyday internet user, as well as for those of us who have seen new speech opportunities arise with these online platforms. I'm very excited to be joined today by two leading experts. First, we have Kathy Gellis, who is a Bay Area practicing attorney, as well as a well-regarded internet expert, and was the author of an amicus brief in the net choice cases. Thank you for joining us from out in California and being here with us in DC. And then I'm also joined by Neil Chilson, who is a senior research fellow at the Center for Growth and Opportunity, and also the former chief technologist of the Federal Trade Commission. So thank you both for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
As a reminder, in case you have just tuned into our event, if you're joining us online, you may join the conversation and submit questions for our panelists at our later Q&A, either using the Q&A form on the webpage, Facebook, YouTube, or on X, formerly known as Twitter, using the hashtag Cato1A. So I want to get started with something that kind of came up in the conversation in oral arguments that I think may have surprised some folks. A lot of us who have been watching these cases for a while have been talking about how these really are First Amendment cases. We hear the term Section 230 thrown around a lot, and in some cases it seems like Section 230 is to blame for whatever a particular policymaker may not like that's going on online. But we did hear Section 230 brought up in the oral arguments. So first off, what is Section 230, and how does it relate to the debate about free speech online?
Section 230 is statutory protection for platforms, and it protects them to do two things. In general, Congress back in the mid-90s had two objectives. They wanted the most good stuff online and the least amount of bad stuff online. And instead of going with a stick-based approach of like whacking the platforms to make them do it exactly the way they wanted to do it, they came up with Section 230 more as a carrot approach to incentivize the platforms to do their moderation to align the incentives so that they would be inclined to do it as best they could. And so that they would be in a position where they could leave the most good stuff up because they wouldn't have to worry about getting in trouble if they left too much of it up and some of it turned out to be not good stuff after all. And it also protected them if they took too much down, because they also wouldn't have to get in trouble if they did take too much down. So they could take the most bad stuff, which was really a major impetus driving Congress, because this is attached to the Communications Decency Act, where Congress was really worried about too much bad stuff on the internet. But they decided that basically we will make it safe for platforms to leave up the most of the good and take down the most of the bad, and they don't have to worry being second-guessed about it. That is important, and it creates statutory protection for the platforms. And these cases do implicate Section 230, because there's a preemption clause in Section 230 that says no state gets to make a law that messes with the paradigm that Congress has passed. And both Florida and Texas have laws that are messing with the paradigm that Congress has passed. Texas and Florida do not like how the platforms have taken down what they think is too much content, and they want there to be liability attached to those decisions, which runs smack into Section 230. So you could deal with these two laws on that basis. But underneath there, there's still a sort of core constitutional principle of do the platforms have their own First Amendment right to choose what content they want to have on their systems and choose what content they don't want to? And the answer constitutionally has to be yes. And the way the the laws have been challenged and the litigation has developed, that has brought that question to the fore. And we can get back to Section 230. If there's a remand, you could always decide that the laws are, they violate Section 230 and thus are no good that way. But you do have that bigger core constitutional question, and it's important to answer that one yes, because otherwise the only thing holding the internet together is Section 230, and it's under fire in a number of respects anyway, and that's not nearly as strong as the Constitution protecting the online ecosystem for expression online.
Neil, in oral arguments and in our lot of conversations, we've heard about Section 230 and the First Amendment as it relates to these online platforms. How do these things come into play when it comes to the user's speech themselves? What could this case mean in terms of what the everyday user may need to understand about the First Amendment and about Section 230?
Well, I liked how Corbin captured it, and Kathy did a great job. I think of the First Amendment as providing a fundamental right, and then Section 230 is tort reform that enables not just the platforms, but also users to exercise that right without the threat of spurious litigation. And so it's essentially a tort reform law. You can think of it that way. And when you think of it that way, I think it clarifies a few things about how the platforms and users might be affected if these laws are changed. And so if the Supreme Court upholds the Florida and Texas laws, I think we've heard some of the alternative approaches on the previous panel. I think Daphne Keller has a good catalog of options that might happen here. You know, you get the fire hose of garbage approach that might happen. You get the only puppies approach that might happen. Or you get like really expensive compliance that doesn't really clear up the problems, but what it does is it adds a lot of litigation costs. And so I think the practical effect for users is that content moderation will continue. It's very likely to continue, but it won't be any clearer about how this happens because these standards are not very clear. And the companies will be in the position of trying to figure out how to best comply with very vague, overreaching laws without diminishing the functionality of their platforms. And I think that's just a very hard nut to crack. I don't think that there's any really good balancing there. And on effect, I think we'd get what Cory Doctorow has called the inshittification of the internet, but from this side of things.
Kathy, I'm going to come to you with a similar but slightly different question, because I think oftentimes these laws get brought up in the idea of they're just about politics. You know, if you're not really engaged in political ideology fights, you don't need to be too worried. This was, you know, kind of a brought forward on a basis of the Florida law specifically about political officials. The Texas law refers to viewpoint. Now, all three of us work on tech policy issues. When we're on various social media platforms, we're often posting about policy, and there could be some debate about whether or not that promotes a specific viewpoint. But if I take a step back and think about some of the other things that I may use the internet for, whether it's posting about running or Taylor Swift or the latest Sarah J. Maas book, what could that mean for the average internet user when it comes to their experience online and their ability to have various conversations?
There's no limiting principle to these laws unless the First Amendment bars them all, full stop. These laws, in theory, are targeted for some of the larger tech platforms that we know and love. It's going to go for Facebook, Google, potentially Twitter, although size is a relevant factor, and Twitter may or may not still be big enough to be underneath them. But let's say there's a whole bunch that, yeah, we know they were going for these platforms, which are platforms that are sort of known as take all comers, all sorts of speech. They're not specialized. But they're challenging that First Amendment right of the platform to exercise its own editorial discretion, which means there's really nothing to prevent these states or any other states to pass their own laws that direct themselves at smaller platforms, specialized platforms that, you know, we have the Puppies Are Us forum, .org, and, you know, they're going to have a hard time keeping the cats off because they won't have the First Amendment right to say no to the cats just to keep up the dogs. This case challenges their right of the, you know, the dog fancier site to keep off the cats. And, you know, and take that for any other specialized site of any other size, individually run websites. So on the amicus brief that I filed, we had an individual Mastodon admin. He runs his site so that he can host conversation among his tech policy colleagues, his friends, the people that he likes, to stimulate conversation he thinks that's important. And his right to do that would be under fire if these laws are blessed, because they gun for the ability of a platform to make the decisions of what speech do I want to allow and what speech do I not want to disallow, and that will apply to every platform on the internet that all of us use kind of without realizing it because, oh, we're not on Facebook, but we're still engaging with an internet intermediary, and it matters to our online experience, and they won't be able to provide that service anymore.
Can I just add to that a little bit, which is that in the CGO brief, amicus brief, we talked about how the First Amendment has a universalizing approach to the U.S., like that the First Amendment is the First Amendment across all of the states. If the Supreme Court decides that the First Amendment does not do that, the First Amendment in coordination with the 14th Amendment does not do that, but that states can sort of craft their own speech environments, what we end up with is, Ash mentioned on the previous panel, balkanization. And so we have a balkanization of First Amendment rights and a balkanization of speech environments. And that means that somebody in California might have different speech rights in practice than somebody in Texas or Florida. And that is just inconsistent with the First Amendment approach of providing protection for fundamental rights. And so, and on top of that, I think it's also just complex both for platforms, but especially for users. If you don't know why your content was taken down in one place or like something that you say doesn't reach people in certain states because they have a different standard, it really does undermine the ability of these the internet to become a conduit for niche or discriminated against views of all kinds. And that's been one of the big benefits of the internet, and I think that that would be one of the benefits that would be taken away under this type of balkanization of First Amendment rights.
It takes away the ability to get anything better. One of my other clients on my amicus brief was Blue Sky. If you're unhappy with the way Twitter looks these days, well, good news, you have a choice. But you only have a choice in a legal ecosystem which gives those new platforms the ability to build themselves up in a way that they believe will most satisfy their user base. If they don't have that freedom to have that discretion, they're not going to be able to exist as well, assuming they can even exist at all. So, you know, even if you, we can talk about this will impinge on specialized platforms, but also impinge on any new general platform where if you don't like the editorial policy exercised by Twitter or Threads, you can go elsewhere. You can go to Blue Sky. You can go to Truth Social. Those sites all depend on the same doctrine that's under fire by Texas and Florida right now.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into this because it's often portrayed, again, that these laws are only about the largest platforms, only about the kind of household names, the Facebooks, the Instagrams, the TikToks, et cetera. But the actual number of monthly active users in the Texas law is 50 million. And yesterday during, or Monday during oral arguments, I was doing a quick search, and that includes platforms like Pinterest, that includes things like Discord, which we heard brought up in the Texas oral arguments, although I think it might have been referred to as Discourse. So I'm assuming I haven't missed the new social media app, but this ecosystem moves so quickly, maybe there is
a That's a feature, not a bug.
Exactly. Okay. Things like Twitch that have a more specific community. And then in the Florida law, there was even discussion about kind of the broader context of user-generated content, how this would impact Etsy, how this would impact Uber. We've dived a lot into that on other platforms, but building off of what you both said, Neil, you brought up that a California user might have different speech rights than a Texas user under these laws. And Kathy, you brought up the number of new platforms. What could this mean for the average user when it comes to that ecosystem of choice? Would they have more choices or fewer choices?
Fewer choices. because the other choices aren't going to be able, they may not be able to exist at all. If, what is the dogfancier.org site supposed to do? Is it allowed to keep off the kitten pictures? This law puts that question into judgment. The only thing that would save it potentially is it's a small site, so it might fall under the radar. But that's not reliable, because if you can say, Florida, you can do this, and Texas, you can do that, then Missouri can do something else, and California can do something else. And there's a lot of states that are trying to do something else, all based on the same principle of, we do not like how platforms are exercising their editorial freedom, and so we're going to go take away that freedom and control it. All the states want to do this in some respect. Their values aren't necessarily the same. I don't think the values of Governor Newsom and the values of Governor Abbott are the same. And then what do? You've got this big collision of two states. One's saying leave this up, and another state is saying take it down. What is the platform supposed to do just on a practical standpoint? How can you possibly comply? So the answer to your question is, if you make life impossible for the platforms who facilitate user speech, that's bad news for the user speech. It's going to have a hard time getting online.
Yeah, on one aspect, you could see, let's say this was a federal type law. You would have a, which is a terrible idea, by the way, don't do that. But if you had something like that, you would get complete homogenization across social media platforms, right? So it wouldn't really make that much of a difference if you were on a different platform, because the content's basically going to be the same. They're only allowed to do, you would get sort of like around the margins, like, which one is willing to take more legal risk than another. But generally, your selection of platforms wouldn't really matter that much. So you get this sort of like nationalization effect, a single provider of social media. But that's not the case that we have here. What we have here is you get a single like standard for each state. And so do you have choice? Well, I guess if you want to pack up your house and move to a different state, yeah, you might have a different set of social media platforms that work differently, but that's the level of choice that you would have to exercise, is physically moving from one state to another. And I know we're going to get into this later, but the analogy is so apt that I'm going to jump right into it. Europe is having this problem, right? Like, this is Europe's entire history of the European Union is, we have a bunch of different places that have their own sets of rules, and we're trying to like get them all to cooperate and get together. And this digital single market effort that they've been going through to try to homogenize basic business principles and other things has led to a lot of laws that are running right into this effort. And so they're trying to like sort of work their way backwards. It's like the U.S. is taking what is a, by all accounts, a quite successful tech innovation environment and retrofitting to be more like Europe in so many ways. And we heard some sympathy for that from the bench yesterday, which was sort of shocking to me, frankly, that we might be, point to what Europe is doing on digital services as a template for how we might want to do things in the U.S. And I just think that's backwards looking, and it's fundamentally inconsistent with the First Amendment as a first principle.
It's not a good plan.
So I do want to move us on to the broader context of where the overall debate about free speech online is. But before I do that, Kathy, as I mentioned, you helped author an amicus brief. Neil, CGO, had an amicus brief as well. I just wanted to give you each an opportunity to highlight any of the arguments that you made in those briefs, particularly as it relates to the impact that this case could have on users.
So I alluded to some of that. I had three clients on my brief. I had Blue Sky, a brand new social media platform that's also innovating a protocol so that you're not dependent on that particular company to provide a platform. With the protocol, other people could implement the software and end up running, essentially, it's just microblogging and microblogging platforms that are able to interact with each other so that you don't have to live in one little silo. You can cultivate your own little silo for a particular community, but because it's got a standard protocol, it can reach users who are using other services to help them get online and facilitate their microblogging experience. Then I also included an individual, Chris Riley, who runs his own Mastodon instance, and that's another that's another example of a microblogging platform which uses a standard protocol so that you can have multiple instances. He can provide access to his friends, and he doesn't have to provide access to people he doesn't like, but that's okay because there will be other Mastodon instances out there that people can subscribe to, and then they'll still be able to talk to users on each platform and share ideas across them in a standard way that has standard treatment. So your experience can still functionally be very Twitter-like, but you don't have to be dependent on one company or one service provider to provide the whole experience. And then the third client I had was the Copia Institute, which you may know more as part of the same company that provides TechDirt, the online legal news policy site. It's a blog, and it's a blog that takes comments. And if you're facilitating user expression in your comments, then all these laws matter to you. You need Section 230 so that you can allow that moderation to happen. And you also need the First Amendment so that you're in the position of having choosing to have comments or choosing not to have comments and having some sort of editorial value around that. And then TechDirt also has the related interest of, it's a speaker, it's a media outlet, it writes lots of blog posts. I write lots of blog posts on it too, and that's very nice to write them. Sometimes we wanna use other platforms to help spread them so we can make sure that everybody reads our brilliant ideas, and we're dependent on other platforms to help that discourse spread. TechDirt also uses other platforms to to facilitate conversations with its users and its user community, from which point it gets tips and other ideas, and it's an ecosystem of how do you engage with your audience. So it also, all these laws also affect something like TechDirt indirectly, because if it, even if it left TechDirt alone, you can have your comments section have fun. If it affects our ability to like tweet our links, then we still have a problem where indirectly taking away and even just impacting the larger platforms ultimately has an impact on other people's expression indirectly. And so these were some of the major points that we wanted to make, that this is, you got to look past Facebook. You have to look past the big tech. This isn't about big tech. This is about an ecosystem of how the internet works, where all expression is dependent on intermediaries to help facilitate that expression. And if you pinch the intermediaries, you're not gonna get any expression. And the irony is that Texas and Florida have said, these laws are about, we're standing up for expression because we don't like that expression got removed. The logical consequence of the regulatory environment they're pushing for is a lot more expression is gonna take a hit.
Neil, anything you wanted to highlight from the CGO's brief before we move on?
Sure. So CGO filed a brief with 11 state think tanks and policy organizations, and we covered the balkanization point that I mentioned earlier, and I won't dig into that so much, but we also covered just the practical realities of the online speech environment right now as one that's highly competitive, very robust, and actually quite open to lots of different viewpoints, including conservative views. We pointed out some of the statistics around the popularity of conservative views on platforms like Facebook, and the fact that in the top 10 posts is very frequently Charlie Kirk and another set of groups who are espousing conservative-styled speech. And so these platforms have been big boons in many ways for people whose speech maybe offends or is not favored by gatekeepers. And I'm always amused by the fact that when conservatives complain about social media sites and the restrictions that they have on their speech, compared to what is the question that economists always ask. If you went back to an era where the New York Times was the record, the paper of record, and there were three broadcast channels, do you think it was easier to get through conservative speech past those gatekeepers than it is now to share your ideas online? I don't think that's true. I think the internet has been a big boon for speech online, and we made that point in the brief. One of the things that we pointed out was that how much times had changed even since these laws were passed. There has already been several mentions of the change of ownership in X to Elon Musk. The Fifth Circuit called Twitter a monopoly. And not only has it changed ownership completely, but there's been a whole ecosystem of Twitter-like companies that have come up, including from some of the other biggest companies that are out there. So you have Threads, which is specifically aimed at being a competitor to Twitter and taking advantage of the fact that maybe users were not as satisfied with the content moderation policies on that platform. So I just think the facts on the ground suggest that the motivations for these laws were not are not well grounded. And that's just, you know, the frosting on top of the fact that this cake is baked without the First Amendment in mind.
So I want to move to kind of the second part of our title about the future of online speech. And in some ways, this relates to the net choice cases, but we do seem to be in this kind of unique moment where there is a lot of friction around online speech, not only from traditionally totalitarian regimes that we've long seen put restrictions on free speech, whether it's online or offline, but also from places in the world that have traditionally been seen as kind of bastions of free speech to some degree. I have to think on one of our prior panels, somebody was joking of, well, if something happens, I might have to move to Canada. And yet it seems like at least rather regularly now we're seeing a potentially free speech cordoning bill out of the Canadian Parliament. I think another one was just introduced yesterday. If we look over in Europe, we've heard the Digital Services Act already mentioned, which there's been a lot of concerns about what that could mean for the future of content moderation and online speech. But we can also look at things that are going on around blasphemy laws reappearing in parts of Europe, or around hate speech laws. We've certainly seen debates around the German hate speech law and its impact. What is going on with free speech around the world, I guess, is my just starter question to both of you.
There is power in expression. It's why we have a First Amendment to protect it, because it's why the powerful don't like it. If you want to maintain your power, you make sure that nobody can talk about it. But I think there's a flip side. So one of the things is very powerful people are unhappy with having their power challenged, and to the extent that they're coming from more autocratic regimes, they're going to use their power to make sure that they disable free expression in order to disable to neutralize the power that might challenge them. But I think you have a slightly different question, but still basically the same power dynamics in what you were talking about, the more liberal places where, well, we're not autocracies, we're democracies, and surely we believe in free speech. And I think one of the things we're bumping into is expression is powerful, and it's empowered an awful lot of people, and not everybody uses that freedom to express themselves necessarily in the most constructive ways. And there's some pain points that come out of how people use their rights of free expression, and particularly how they've been able to use them online. And there are reactions to, wait a second, maybe this isn't good, something should be done. And so reasonable people will say something should be done, and reasonable governments may say, you're right, something should be done, but we are reacting out of reacting to specific incidences that are causing some pain and potentially doing damage, where we're confronting a moment in history where everybody can now talk to each other, and we don't entirely know how to do that well, and we're learning, and there's some growing pains as we figure this out. It's really incumbent even on the liberal democracies to take a more hands-off approach, to not try to over-control things, because if you over-control things, you all of a sudden turn into the autocracy, because you will embed power in people who are able to seize it and use it, and there won't be a way to challenge it because you've squelched the right that other people have to express themselves in ways that would challenge that power. And, you know, it may be motivated by legitimate concerns, legitimate fears, but it's a dangerous path to go down, because there's no way to do it where you just get rid of the bad stuff and keep the good stuff. The reason why we articulate our doctrine of free expression the way we do is that you've got to get the government out of the way, because nobody can effectively decide in a way that we will all agree what is the good stuff and what is the bad stuff. And once you start trying to decide, you've basically blown the opportunity for the freedom to exist in a way that it just gives somebody the power to decide, and they'll decide in ways that suit them and don't necessarily suit the greater good.
I'd say, Kathy, your point that ideas are powerful They're maybe the most powerful thing. And so the history of technology that empowers people to spread ideas is one of big disruption and one of causing a lot of societal change. And so when you look back to the printing press, not nearly as effective for the individual as to spread information as social media platforms. You had institutions that were not, certainly there was not a First Amendment, generally speaking. There were some free speech principles, but that was such a disruptive technology to the status quo institutions that Europe had like 100 years of war over it, right, essentially. And so I don't think that it should be surprising to us that there is a lot of people looking out there and saying, look, I like free speech. It's great. I just don't like it when those guys say those things. And so that seems like a problem to me. I mean, that is the history of humankind in communication. We need to stick to the principle because that principle is pretty time-tested at this point. We've seen that we as a society can adapt to new forms of communication. I always think back to something that Adam Theorer told me, and it was a real eye-opener to me, about the difference between the fights on technology where that don't involve speech and the fights that do involve speech. When we fight about technologies that don't involve speech, there is a tech panic cycle, right? There's always early adopters who really like it and are on the bleeding edge, and they're not quite sure what to do with it, but they're kind of exploring it and figuring it out. Then you get sort of a backlash. You get this peak panic. Sometimes government acts, sometimes they don't. But you know, eventually, basically, it gets absorbed into society. We all use it. Automobile, I mean, just think any technology. That's basically what we're talking about. Speech platforms, because of the threat that they hold to those who are in charge, that cycle never, you never get past that cycle. And so the history of new media is always one of government trying to control it. And those in power trying to control it. It's not just government. It could just be elite institutions that are the incumbents trying to control it. That's what we're going through right now, is the fight of elite institutions to maintain their hold that they've had on the ability of people to communicate ideas. That hold and those structures, they have benefits, but they have huge drawbacks as well. And the history of the First Amendment in the U.S. suggests that we need to help them let go and help build new institutions that help us learn how to talk to each other better online and off.
Actually, can I respond to myself real quick? I framed it in the negative about why, okay, things are tough or challenged. Legitimate people for legitimate reasons are afraid and want to do something. And I said, oh, don't do that, because you're just going to empower more of what you don't like. And that is all true. But people don't like responding to the, what do you mean I can't, I have to just put up with this because it'll be worse if I don't. There is something else to be said. There is a positive way of thinking about it, that the way through the things that challenge us today is to maintain the freedoms that will allow us to solve our problems, because we're not throwing arbitrary obstacles in our way to prevent us from innovating the solutions that we need. The actual answer to this is, I know it hurts now, but keep going, because that's how you get through this.
Muddle through.
More than muddle through. That freedom, we can sit here and have all the colloquiums we want, and we will get to better choices, better days, because we're going to be able to come up with better ideas, and we'll come up with better platforms, and we'll come up with better services. This is what's going to make the world better, because we don't have things standing in our way saying no to the things that would be better. So maintaining that freedom is absolutely important to make sure that you can have something better, and whenever you clip the wings of that, you clip your ability to actually solve your problems.
Before I move on to one of those newer expression-based technologies, or at least debatably expression-based technologies, I do want to ask one more question about this kind of overall environment of free expression, which is basically, why should your average American user care? We have the First Amendment here. Why should they perhaps be paying attention to what's going on in Europe with the DSA, or what's going on in Canada with their various potential regulations? Is it just a matter of, because we heard kind of vague references to it at the Supreme Court in this case, or is there something bigger for free expression that may mean the average user needs to pay attention?
They'll miss it when it's gone. There is some question about how soon, how dramatically. Will it be more like turning up the heat on a pot, or will it be more like being thrown into something more traumatic originally? But if you remember what the world is like today, and we don't preserve the First Amendment as it's being challenged right now, today is going to be a day that the future will never be able to imagine. It's going to be so far into their lived experience, and good luck with maintaining democracy in that context.
So I think there's a bunch of different answers about why I pay attention to the overall arc. One is just a basic empathy for other humans. I mean, the First Amendment rights that we have in the U.S., other people deserve those rights too. In fact, they have those rights. Their governments just don't protect them. And so I think that sort of ceding the world to a view that government should be managing how people express themselves is something that we should all feel is not just un-American, but it's bad for humans. And so so I would say we should pay attention to those things. The other more practical reason is because a lot of these regimes are building technologies, China, for example, or they're building legal technologies that are serving as templates around the world. And some of that is coming back into the U.S. as well. And so we saw a small example of that on the bench, but we've seen lots of examples of that in Congress and in the state legislatures, where they are looking to what Europe is doing around this and sort of putting on blinders as to the actual very demonstrable effects that it's had on the European ability to build new technologies, and saying, we want to do that too. And so those templates are not going to go away. I think it's worth engaging in that fight, not just here, but around the world, because people around the world deserve to have tools that empower them and deserve and have the right to speak their minds.
You know, it wouldn't be a tech policy event in 2024 if we didn't discuss artificial intelligence and AI. So I apologize, but we're going to have to ask some questions about artificial intelligence and AI, and particularly how it relates to both the future of free expression online as well as to some of the debates that we're currently having. So, Neil, I'm going to start with you, and I think you kind of brought up an interesting framework in your answer to a prior question. Is artificial intelligence one of those technologies where we're going to have kind of the free expression side of the techno-panic and debate, or do you think it's a different type of technology, and how are we already seeing that play out?
Wow, it's a great question. Way to take my framework and spit it back at me. Now I got to apply it in real time. So I think AI does affect this. There were some mentions of it during oral argument, but the CGO brief also mentioned it as artificial intelligence and algorithms are inherent in the processes that these companies are using when they're dealing with massive amounts of content online. And so some of the briefs had argued essentially that this means that it can't be the platform's speech. I thought there were some really great points made on the earlier panel that there doesn't have to be a clear message. It's not like it's the AI's message. That doesn't matter. The point is somebody designed that to try to create an environment. That is the freedom of the press, maybe even the freedom of association to have people on that platform and engaged or not. So there's that sort of application. But now to dial back to my framework, I think actually AI, the generative AI technology that we're talking about, not just algorithms, more broadly, but the sort of large language models, ChatGPT, the image creation, things like Midjourney, is actually quite different than social media in a bunch of ways. First, on the sort of free expression and the choice range, the market signals are much clearer with generative AI than they are in social media. When I put a post on TikTok or on Twitter and it doesn't go viral, like, it's really hard for me to figure out why. When I ask Gemini to generate, you know, founding fathers, and it gives me back something that looks historically incredibly inaccurate, although admirably diverse, it's pretty easy to tell, right? And so those signals, I think we're seeing right now that there are immense market pressures on these types of tools to calibrate to what their consumers want. And that, it's not that that doesn't exist in the social media space, but the signals are much less direct. The second thing that's quite different is that Well, first of all, there's a lot of these models are essentially pay models. They're not ad-driven. And so that just has a whole bunch of different potentials for how they deal with customers. I think the third one is that choice is much easier in this space in some ways, right? Like one of the big values of social networks, not always, but often, is that they have a big reach. And so there's these network effects where it's kind of hard to leave a platform, even if you're not super happy with it, because you're invested in the network that you have there. That is definitely not true in the AI content generation space. People try something here, they try something there, they compare it, they see which one they like better. They might use it for this type of thing on this day and use it for a different thing. There's the ability to switch is much easier. And so I think the free speech dynamics in AI are quite, generative AI are quite different than social media. And so I have cautioned ever since the first hearing on generative AI, where essentially Congress brought their social media talking points to the generative AI discussion, we shouldn't think of these things as the same. They're quite different.
One of those social media talking points that's been brought to the generative AI discussion is, of course, back to our old friend, Section 230. So, Kathy, I'm going to turn to you with the question that seems to be on everyone's mind. What is your take on, does Section 230 apply to generative AI?
It can. I mean, So you told me we were going to talk about AI, and I told you I'd probably roll my eyes. And the reason I roll my eyes is because this new buzzword is just swallowing up all the oxygen. And, you know, it's not like we really sorted out our doctrinal understanding of anything else before we threw this new technology. So, like, we're still figuring out, does the First Amendment apply to the internet? How does Section 230 work? And now we've added this degree of difficulty where you have this technology that's part buzzword, part pie in the sky, part some really stupid ideas, and an awful lot of fear and moral panics that are probably not well-founded. And it's all coming together in this morass. I think the answer to your question is, go back and understand Section 230, because essentially everything comes down to first principles. How does the First Amendment work? How does Section 230 work? All of these principles can then be scaled up and applied to technology. Like, I don't buy what I think Justice Alito said at the hearing of, like, well, the First Amendment long ago predated the internet. It also predated most of the periodic table and our discovery of most of the elements we take for granted now. I'm not just talking the ones at the radiation, like the above 100s. I mean, some really core ones that, like, you know, they hadn't found them yet, but they're, like, integral to our lives. You can have constitutional freedoms that scale up for technology. You can have statutes that predate certain evolution of technology, like Section 230, continue to apply. I think for Section 230 itself, it comes down to the core question. Of the specific expression at issue that somebody is objecting to, who imbued it with the quality that is now objectionable? I don't want to even say wrongful, because sometimes it's just people throw lawsuits because they don't like it and then they're going to lose the lawsuit, but Section 230 defends whether the lawsuit is meritorious or not. And I think that's the question. That's always the question in Section 230. Who imbued the content with its wrongful quality? If it was a user who created a message, and if they created the message using the tool, then it is probably them, in which case Section 230 will apply to insulate the intermediary from any other liability. But if it was the intermediary employing this particular technology as part of their platform services that used the technology to create expression that had a wrongful quality, then 230 doesn't apply because it's their speech directly. The exact same questions that apply without AI apply with AI, and what worries me is we've gotten really bad at applying them to the non-AI situations. It would be nice if we got them right and settled before we moved on and made it harder, but the same principles apply.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So I think, you know, if you go back to my framing of Section 230 as tort reform, we need tort reform in lots of spaces. So whether or not Section 230 applies to generative AI models, I do think that the legal principle that we should deter bad behavior by the people who commit that bad behavior rather than the tools they use applies across the board. And so we may need to figure out some ways to do that in the generative AI space. But I do think that it is an important principle of U.S. law that we need to make sure applies to your point, properly in the generative AI space.
Actually, I just want to punctuate that with one comment, because you've used the tort reform. That may work in this crowd. It's not going to work with some of the bluer crowds. I think the other way of framing Section 230 is more as a rule of civil procedure, because what it ends up doing is cutting down on abusive lawsuits that are challenging expression, and in particular challenging the rights of first expression that the platforms have, so that they can be in the position of saying yes to content and saying no to content. If you think about it in those terms, A, I think you'll have more political traction across the spectrum, but I think that's also the power of why Section 230 is important. And when you extrapolate it out to these new technologies, the same things apply. We are worried about a chilling effect of litigation slowing down things that should be constitutionally protected, innovation and expression. Section 230 says thou shalt not sue, you know, in certain circumstances. And I think framing it like that, of that's what its job is to do, then when you look at that job, then you apply it to AI and see where does it need to kick in to make sure we're not chilling, you know, good and useful innovations of AI technology.
I do want to take some time and turn to audience questions. I'm going to start with a question from online while our mic runners can start going to some of the hands in the room, which I thought was a very interesting question, which is one of the ways we've seen users using the internet is for various modes of digital activism. What could be the implication of these cases for digital activism online?
Well, I know your brief touched on that on behalf of Copia Institute, and we also touched on that in the CGO brief on behalf of the state think tanks, who are big users of social media platforms to get their messages out. And if these laws go into effect, the platforms will be faced with, well, if I post something from this group, I'm going to have to make sure that it's balanced by, you know, something from the opposite side. Even if nobody else wants to hear, you know, it could be my, that's a little biased. Nobody wants to hear my opponent's arguments, really, they just want to hear mine. And so that creates a lot of friction. It creates a chilling effect on the platforms. And I think for the advocacy groups that I work for, who for whom social media has been a big megaphone for their ideas, it makes it harder for them to continue to spread their ideas on state policy reform.
Yeah, I think if you're thinking, well, this can't happen to me, you might get lucky, but you'd just be getting lucky. This is not good for any... Look, there are certain social movements that know they are not popular in Texas and Florida. You know, Texas, even the most content-neutral way of approaching it is... that is a rule that says platforms can't host an entire category of topic, pro or con, which means that, you know, would you like to discuss reproductive freedoms? I mean, you can't because the platforms can't host it at all, or else if they have to host yours, they're going to host exactly the view that you don't want. And really, these laws challenge the ability of platforms to say yes to anything that's provocative if the government that they're that is going to reach them wants to say no to that. And, you know, you have social activism because you are challenging some prevailing views, but the prevailing views have a lot of power, and if they have the power over the platforms to say, and can force them to say no to what you want to say, then how are you going to be able to speak against it? Or for it, for that matter.
I'll go to our audience for a question.
I really appreciated the focus on 230 at the beginning and the end, a distinction from the First Amendment and the notion of tort reform. And yet, when we compare ourselves to the rest of the world, and we look over time as to why did we need the tort reform, I'm hoping you can say a little more about the Wolf of Wall Street and why we got 230, and why the U.S. culture of lawsuits is uniquely hazardous to platforms, because the rest of the world doesn't have a Section 230.
To their detriment. I think one issue that came up, and I know that Paul Clement, I think, raised it before the court, is you had a situation where it wasn't just that the platform's ability to say no to certain content or say yes to certain content was under fire. They were in a position where if they looked at the content and had knowledge of what was there and then made a decision, they would be in super duper extra trouble. And that looking at it and having some sense of what was going on ended up being the link that caused them to potentially be liable. And that was not sustainable because Because basically it would mean at that point that even if you had the right to leave the content up or take the content down, you couldn't do a better job than that. Your tools were crude, because you couldn't investigate what you had, and then you couldn't do a very effective job. So basically you got out of the content moderation business because you could not afford legally to be in the content moderation business, because that meant you were paying attention to what was there, and if you paid attention to what was there, then all of a sudden you became responsible for what you found, and your choices were always going to be subject to challenge, and that's just too expensive, because this happens on a scale that most people cannot get their heads around. Even the smallest platform deal with thousands, if not millions, of posts in very short periods of time.
So yeah, the common law torts that were at issue in a bunch of the cases that motivated Section 230, you know, common law evolves. It doesn't always evolve that quickly. It evolves through a series of court decisions over time. And, you know, I think there is a possible world in which we got, without Section 230, we got gradual movement towards something that continued to protect the First Amendment despite, lots of litigation from people who wanted to bring defamation claims. But that would not have been fast, and it certainly wouldn't have been at the pace that would have enabled this technology, which was quite new, the internet, to blossom and prosper. So I think that Section 230 stepped in there. Congress stepped in and said, hey, we see a problem here. We want this innovation. We want it to be in a way that lets people deliver what users want without being sued out of existence by under a system that is quite different from the rest of the world in a lot of different ways. But one way in particular is that we don't have a loser pays sort of provision that says, hey, if you bring a spurious lawsuit, then you have to and you impose costs on somebody that you then have to like compensate them back, and that's. And that system just means that if you see somebody with big pockets, it's worth the risk to lose in court because you're just out a little bit of money, but you might get a whole lot of money at the end.
A lot of people with small pockets.
Or you troll a lot of people with small pockets. And fixing that problem is a much bigger one. Well, it's bigger in sort of, it's more general than social media and Section 230. But Section 230 steps into that and is a good start, maybe, for how we might treat other areas where there is a certain level of scale and where the deep-pocketed intermediaries are likely to face lots of targeted litigation.
I think I'm going to go to another question. We're bringing another mic.
Thank you. Juan Londoño with Taxpayers Protection Alliance. So I think this panel and all the panels today have shown the dichotomy of what's happening with this this case where probably platforms are going to be forced to carry that, like, you know, all viewpoints and potentially dangerous viewpoints. But if we zoom out to other bills and other lawsuits that are happening around the country that want to make platforms liable for dangerous content and allege that platforms designed that lead to harms should held these platforms liable, we ended a compliance nightmare. And if all those dominoes were to fall in that place, in this nightmare scenario, you think platforms would err in the side of that hyper-regulation or hyper-moderation of only poppy content, extremely safe content, or it would go to a side of no moderation at all and just let everything fly and just say, look, we're not even moderating. We cannot be held liable for what's going on here.
Possibly both, and neither are good. I think there are some platforms that will be in a position where they'll try to hang on, but they'll basically be like, we can't touch anything because we're not protected. I mean, that is a particular problem if Section 230 takes a hit, but I think even these cases implicate that problem. But, you know, if they're being forced to do things in certain ways, they'll have to take very conservative views about what is the okay content. That's going to be very narrow. We may not even agree on the puppies and kittens because We may have to choose puppies or kittens. So everything can be contentious, and I don't think there's going to be a lot of safe content, but we will end up with such an anodyne online ecosystem because that is the only thing that will be available, and companies will limp along and try to do the best they can, but it's not going to be good.
Neil, before I let you go in, I have to bring up, because we've used this puppies and kittens example multiple times through the course of this event, and it has to make me think of one of my favorite subreddits that I have learned about, which is a subreddit that is only pictures of cats standing up. So everyone's got it. The rule is cats standing up. Simple subreddit, what you can and cannot post. Cats standing up. How many legs does a cat stand up on?
Oh, dear.
Ah, big fight.
Very, very quick to get to the type of concern, even with some of these, yeah. You know, you're only going to allow puppy pictures. How old is a puppy? Like, when does a puppy become a dog? I call every dog a puppy, therefore, can I post this picture? Mm-hmm. You know, type of thing. I think even in these hyper-contextualized situations, it can still get tough, and there still can be some degree of viewpoint involved.
And I think that's the thing that kind of runs through these policy tensions, where even if you take assume that some of these regulators are well-intentioned because they're looking at problems that are, you know, externalities from the internet which are socially undesirable, you get so focused on that and you're like, shouldn't it be easy to just get rid of that? As you're pointing out, we can't even necessarily agree that that is worth striking out, but that's not the picture. Even if we could, that's not the whole picture. The internet is reflecting all of humanity, and there's, what are we up to, 8 billion of us now? We're a lot of people, and complex and wrinkled and nuanced and different and varying. How do you reduce our social experience, which we can replicate online, into something where we can say good, bad, good, bad, good, bad? Like, and I think our notion, we have this illusion that we can control. You can't. You can't. Even the most well-meaning regulator cannot control the online world as perfectly as they'd want to, any more than they can control the offline world as perfectly as they might like to control it. You can't have that and also have a thriving humanity.
Having written a book called Getting Out of Control, I love that last point. That's very good. On the impacts of these laws on what the companies do, I think one thing that hasn't come up much, although Paul Clement like mentioned it multiple times in oral argument, is that Florida has a where individuals can sue to enforce the law, and with a $100,000, I think, judgment possible. And so that's like the opposite of tort reform, right? And that is monetizing the sort of online gripe ecosystem, where if anything happens to you and you don't get like full disclosure about exactly what it was, you're going to be able to bring a lawsuit. You might not win. In fact, maybe you won't win at all, but it might be worth it, you know, to do that, because not only will you win sometimes, but also you're going to shape the conduct of the companies in a way that is much different than, say, where the companies are in constant communication with, you know, a prosecutor who has limited resources and limited incentives necessarily, and also can be sort of cajoled into not doing something occasionally. So neither of those are great situations, but the Florida private right of action, I think, is especially ripe for abuse by people who want to sue deep pockets.
So we're running out of time. I know we had a lot of great questions come in online, and that there are some people in the room that I wasn't able to get to. Hopefully, you know, we'll be able to continue these conversations, both online, on the various platforms that you and our other speakers are on, as well as for those of you who are in the room over lunch shortly. If we could first all take this opportunity to join me in thanking all of our speakers, not only on this panel, but throughout the day. Needless to say, I think one of the big takeaways has been that there's still plenty to discuss. Whatever we end up hearing from the court in the next 4 or so months about the future of these cases and what that might mean for the future of online speech, there are plenty of other topics going on that we didn't even touch on today, whether it was the upcoming case formerly known as Missouri v. Biden, now Murphy v. Missouri, whether it's the ongoing debate around some of the other state social media laws that we've seen that were not part of this challenge, or whether it's what we started to discuss in this last panel about debates around speech and generative AI, or what's going on in other countries. So I know that myself and my Cato colleagues, as well as several of our panelists, are always looking into and writing about these topics, and I would invite you to follow all those that work online via various platforms or via different individuals' methods of sharing. For those of you that are here with us, this is going to conclude our sessions. I thank you for joining, and lunch will be served upstairs. For those of you online, this also concludes our sessions, and I thank you for joining and look forward to seeing your conversation online. Thank you.